Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling spectacular.
Oh,
yeah.
Why?
Because, well, A, there's many reasons, actually. A, it's season 14, can you believe it, of Talk Art. I think we've recorded something like plus 200, like more than 200 episodes now. This might even be our 200th episode. And today we are meeting an incredible artist who you, Russell Tovey, introduced me to initially. Mm-hmm. And about this time last year or a bit later, I read an amazing interview online with her. And she was talking about the challenges during the pandemic and the way that she encountered boredom, and it really struck a chord with me, because you and I were so hectic in the pandemic that we almost didn't have time for boredom. And I remember thinking about this idea that when you're a kid, that kind of space you can create for yourself for imagination and freedom. And there's even like friends of mine talk about parenting, and they talk about this idea that like when you're a parent, you try and structure every single hour. You know, we've got friends, mutual friends who have kids now, and like they're all like working out everything to keep their kids entertained and educated and, you know, energetic and sporty and all these things. But actually what you need to do is encourage boredom. And there was this beautiful, beautiful quote, which I'm going to read really quickly, because this is what stuck in my mind when I first discovered her work. She said that my senses became heightened for a hunt of the spectacular amongst the wreck of the day. And I just think that sums up so much about what Talk Art has been about, why you and I love art, why all the people listening, whether they're creative or not, this idea that you can transform your day, that you can, you know, be at your darkest point or your most bored point, and you can still find something truly spectacular. It also got me thinking about Dracula Spectacular, which I was in. I actually was Dracula in the musical at school, Russ. Did you know that?
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, you missed that one. But anyway, I just love today's artist. I find her work totally extraordinary. It's got me thinking a lot about abstract art, but also non-representational art, which I didn't really ever see as two distinct things. So I'm excited to talk about that as well. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Pam Evelyn. Hi, Pam.
Hello, welcome.
How welcome are you? To your world. Yes,
it's true. Right now we're looking at you in an incredibly vast studio with brand new paintings behind you. It's such an exciting sight.
Oh, it's been an amazing time. This is a studio I've been in here for about a month now, and it's just extraordinary. There's so much space in here, and I've been able to really make some cracking big canvases to work on, and they're all in a nice stage where things are just slowly warming up now, so it's like the perfect time to talk.
You normally work in big scale. People who come to your paintings will see that they're vast, but you're now in another studio where you're able to go even bigger with your scale.
Yeah, even bigger. I mean, the funny thing is sometimes canvases, you know, it's, something feels big, and then when you put it actually in this environment where the space allows big work to be on the wall, it automatically shrinks. And when you don't have the distractions of drawings or other work around a painting, and it's just standing there on its own, actually everything can become quite small again. So this work, it's nice because it's really going huge. And I've got these three large panels behind me, but there's three behind those. So it's six panels in a row. And it's just going to be this sort of expanse of space. And it really enables me to explore big gestures in my work and use my arm and shoulder in making the work.
So you obviously work on more than one painting at a time. Do you work series, like we're seeing all these works behind you now? Will these become one body of work that you're aiming towards, or can these be separate kind of adventures?
I think, yeah, they're sort of all made in the same breath, as it were. So they all feed off of each other. And sometimes I turn paintings around, I face them to the wall. And so I can only see maybe three paintings at a time. And that prevents them all becoming too similar and relying on each other as a crutch too much. Because when you have lots of paintings out all at once, and that's all you look at day after day, sometimes the information can bleed a bit too much, and then the works almost get lost in each other's company. And really, it is quite important to allow each painting to exist in its own right and not rely on anything else.
Wow. So they have so each painting has its own personality. It's like they are part of the same family, but you're setting them free to go and have their own careers, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and sometimes there's a really natural show that can occur. So I had this, my first episode I show was Spectacle of a Wreck with Press Projects in Berlin. And what was really extraordinary is that work was made during COVID, and it wasn't actually made for anything. It was a body of work that I was just making to pass time and really understand what I could actually do with paint. And then this body of work came out of that, and I was asked to do this solo show, and naturally there was just a show that made sense with the work I had made during that time. So really, I think it's this natural thing. I think maybe writers, musicians have the same thing that happens to them. Your mind is in a specific place, and that work then portrays that mindset quite clearly.
Can we talk about a particular work in that show in Berlin? Because it blew my mind. It's called Spine Fence, and it's 2021. And I think it's one of the most extraordinary works I've seen in the last decade. It's just literally, I know that sounds like hyperbolic, but it's true. I think it's such an outstanding work. And it's composed of like three separate canvases, I think, that then come together as a whole. Can you talk a bit about that specific work, like honing into that show? Because I love that show in Perez Projects. I think it's extraordinary.
Well, that was a very strange painting that I made. It was these three panels, and every single time the painting came into completion with these three panels, I would jumble it up. So I'd completely throw off the composition. And what would happen was almost, it was like the self-destruction. So the title, Spectacle of a Wreck, was kind of touching on the point that I was making these paintings in almost a self-sabotage mindset, where if the work came to completion, I would just throw it all off and have to react to that. So it was almost like, yes, this sort of salvage operation and reacting to this sort of self-destructive way of creating. But in that destruction was some real beautiful moments, and also revealed, I don't know, like a vulnerability to what can happen when a painting collapses and you have to then recover and find that moment where everything's balanced again. So it's like this dance in that painting that finally came together.
This process of self-sabotage is something that you really rely on. It seems like you start a process of painting, of trying to fuck yourself up, basically, and test yourself, and then try and almost solve the puzzle of what the painting is. But that's a really fascinating place to kick off every work from.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess it's sort of a place where when you feel like you're in the deep end, or you feel like you're acting in this sort of recovery mode and you're getting sort of lost in the work, I just feel like you surprise yourself. So it's kind of like this intimate moment where when things sort of go off and you allow the painting to sort of escape a more controlled, mannered, designed way of making. So it's really me trying to shed any preconceived plan or even sort of shed kind of an expectation of the painting. And it's like putting myself as the viewer. So instead of dictating what the painting should be, I place myself in a position where the painting tells me where it's going, and I just sort of have to react. And I think it's, for me, just a very surprising way of making a painting, and it seems to work. And I like the challenge. I like the kind of unexpected.
It's incredibly existential in some ways. There's a quote that you had where you said, I began to familiarize myself with the temper and nature of my touch. As if you, like you're saying, you're not in charge of this, and you're trying to work out and feel what your instinct is. And this must constantly surprise you then. You must be creating these works and stepping back and going, where did that come from? And what is this? It's quite psychological.
Yeah, it's very very psychological. I mean, there's this balance I have with sort of enabling the outside world. I mean, I love landscape, and I look at Mirandi a lot. Weirdly, I'm absolutely obsessed with his touch, because in those paintings he really simplifies the subject, but through that he exposes this amazing kind of emotion through touch. And for me, it's just tapping into that and almost trying to witness, the being the witness instead of controlling things. And it's a very temperamental place to be. I get very, very kind of caught up in it, and sometimes when it's going wrong I feel sort of completely at loss and despair. But at the same time, I think, you know, brilliant moments of creation can come from that. And I think that's the place I like to sort of position myself in.
Do you ever get moments of like channeling the muse almost? Like, I know if people write songs, they often just open their mouth and things pour out of their mouth, like words, you know, melodies, as you're writing a song on a piano or a guitar.
Improvising.
Yeah. And just, and yes, it's almost like a spiritual kind of loss of yourself, like the opposite almost of the psychology. Do you have moments of those where your mind just goes blank and you can just paint and you're free in that moment?
Do you know, I chase that moment all the time. I think that's really where any painter would love to kind of enter that headspace. But realistically, I don't very often. I think it takes just a long time of shedding that ego, not asking too much from a painting, stop chasing a masterpiece or anything like that, and allow things to really kind of break away and dissolve into that moment of improvisation and chance, but really going with that. That's a really beautiful way of putting it, actually.
What is the emotion then you feel when you know the painting's complete? And do you put work out there and then have a moment once it's been in the world, once it's in an exhibition, of going like, oh no, I need to get back into this?
So to be honest, I've noticed that when a painting's close to completion, I'm just about to think, right, that's going in the bin, and you know, about to kind of chuck it out, and feel like it's completely at the point of just like a disaster, and then it clicks and something then works, and it pulls itself back together almost as if out of the blue, suddenly everything's working again. And that's the moment for me, usually, when the painting sort of self-realizes and becomes a painting that I can walk away from and accept the fact that it's finished.
So you're normally based in London. So we find you now in this vast studio. You've took up a residency somewhere, right?
Yes. So this is Anchor Studio. It's with Porthmore Studios, and it's based in New Lynn. And it's the most incredible space. I mean, the history here is amazing. Someone called Stanhope Forbes, he built this studio, and he would teach here. And there's been a whole history of students coming here and learning how to paint. And they also worked a lot outside as well. So this whole studio was designed to really be exposed to the elements without being actually affected by the elements. And I've got the most amazing view of the New Lynn and the fishermen who are always busy out there. And it's incredible. And then after Forbes was John Wells, who is also a very significant painter. He was friends with Peter Lanyon. There was just the most amazing history of painting that exists here. And so I sort of escaped here to just find out why. Why were artists so encouraged to come here and paint?
And you found, you're discovering why, because you feel like you've really invigorated there and inspired.
Yeah, very much. It's kind of this beautiful thing where all of a sudden there's nature surrounding me. I've encountered sort of depths of loneliness that are really important. You know, it's perspective as to what I have achieved, where I'd like to take painting. And it was an intimidating place to enter, but it's worked out. And I think that everyone needs to do it one time in their life to really sort of think and have that time alone. And it's just very different to London.
Yes.
London's very loud and very busy. And I just needed to kind of pull away from that and slow down.
Yeah.
Do you see the colours in the work shifting because of your location and the light, and like, even if you're experiencing the outdoors as you're on your way to the studio every day, is that having an impact on the work? Because I can already notice it looks quite like fresh what's behind you, you know, like
botanical.
In the sense of the
yes.
It feels like a different palette slightly.
Yeah, I mean, the light here is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I read about that, that's one thing they would say, something about Cornwall light. But it's definitely real. I can sort of sense it throughout the day. It's just extraordinary. And I guess I've chosen a really good time as well. I've come down here during summer, as you can see by my glowing red. But yeah, it's just extraordinary. And actually, I've been going out at night. I went swimming at 1 a.m. once with some friends. And yeah, that was extraordinary, because the light glowing on the flesh in the sea, and the sea was black, and then our bodies just illuminated by obviously the moonlight or something. It's just a moment I'll never forget. It's small things like that kind of sustain on your memory, and then that feeds into the work one way or another.
I think that the stain on your memory, there's another quote where you said about the stain of the everyday enters the studio.
Yeah,
and it's like an excavation. You know, the title of the show at Perez Projects was Spectacle of a Wreck, which was based on a shipwreck in Scotland that you saw. And it's this kind of mining archaeological energy which you have with paint.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. And also the show, the approach was built on clay. And that was basically all about the fact that my foundation, I see the canvas is very slippery foundation where every application sinks, and then I'm constantly trying to rebuild, and everything kind of is drawn in and then comes back out, and forms are sort of reiterated over and over again. And I guess it is also sort of this pace that I was thinking about, like my paintings take quite a long time to make. And I felt like I was sort of walking through mud at times making these paintings. And then I just thought about looking slowly, like that's such an important thing, paintings that ask for you to look slowly. So that show was sort of all about just I was hoping that my paintings would just slow down this idea of looking, and the paintings would reveal themselves gradually bit by bit, sort of meet you halfway and then tease you in some more. So
as a maker, talking about that looking slowly, so teaching yourself that or understanding that in your own practice, when you then go off to galleries and see other artists' work, do you find yourself practicing what you want to preach when you are a viewer?
Little bit. Yeah, I need to stop. Yeah, you become, I guess it's very hard to, when you do something, when you look at work and you also paint, it's very hard not to project and assume. And it's about being open and looking at other painters, looking at the risks they take, and understanding that you know, painting's so broad that there's loads of different ways of doing it. But yeah, it's hard to shed the fact that I'm a painter and I have my ways of doing something. But yeah, it's just about reading what's in front of you and trying to step into their shoes, you know.
And I heard this word used in a bio of yours, I think on Marcel Joseph's website, who's a friend of mine. She's a great collector and philanthropist.
Oh, yeah,
and it,
yeah,
it said palimpsestic surface. And this word palimpsest, used to really freak me out, because in the early days of me going to art galleries, I remember there being something about palimpset. And it was so esoteric to me and so kind of like exclusionary as a word, because I just like did not understand it. And even when I looked it up, I just was a bit like, but how does that relate to art? Because it's about manuscripts and like drawing over existing, I don't know, maps or manuscripts or paper or whatever. But then when I heard it in the context of your work, it suddenly sort of fell in place. I was like, oh yeah, of course. It's like, it can be a surface that you like have layers and layers of. Can you talk a bit about like this idea of the layers, because I can see it behind you right now, the way might begin with a full complete canvas painted, but then you sort of go completely over it again.
Yeah, so actually Marcel Joseph, she was one of my first ever studio visits, and that was an amazing moment. Actually, it was, I think I had the studio in London for about, well, a few months. And then finally some people were coming in. She was one of the first, and it was a really great moment. She is very knowledgeable about painting. But yeah, so I love that description. And I think, so I love Ashiel Gorky.
Oh yeah.
Because he got to a stage, and actually de Kooning did as well, when they didn't need all those layers. Later on in their life, they would just touch, one touch, and it said everything. And it was just this effortless, unedited spillage of expression. I mean, one day I hope I get there, but at the moment I reiterate, I cover up, I camouflage, I rework, I deface, you know, all these things, because I think painting, unlike drawing, where drawing sort of exposes everything, it's much harder to re-edit yourself in drawing. That's why drawing's so important, actually, because unlike painting, you can't disguise with drawing, but with painting, I still need to rework, and I'm not at the point where I can just one touch and walk away.
And actually, in relation to the idea of slowing down as well, like, you know, going to where you are right now in a much more like peaceful location, in a sense, you said a quote before as well that was like, half of what painting is resisting the act of painting and living with it. So it's almost like the idea of pulling back and resisting to keep painting and to sort of withdraw from that act and then really think about the decision making. It's quite intense. I mean, I just, I'm really glad I'm not a painter, actually, because I think it's one of the hardest things.
I think there's like a certain addiction to it. You know, you make a painting, you finish it, and then you're on to the next. So it's this, you're never satisfied.
Yeah.
Because you're always striving to create the next one. Is there an addictive tendency to being an artist?
I think there must be. I mean, I think there's sort of this hunger of finding. And when you find whatever, for me, I mean, when I find whatever one painting, you know, it gets to a completion, you found a resolve, that hunt, it's such a kind of, it's an interesting way of looking at the world. It makes you kind of act like an observer and take everything in. And I suppose everyone has their outlet. But with painting, it kind of offers so much in terms of expression, working, you know, life, working life out on the canvas. And it's also this sort of historic thing. I mean, it almost traces your every step, you know. And I talk to painters in their 50s and they talk about paintings they made when they were in their 20s. And it's incredible that, you know, you're even able to do that and have that vast kind of trace of your life. And I think that is an addictive thing to get into, but also it's just very giving. And I think there's a lot to be said about what painting does.
Do you see yourself in the lineage of an art movement or within an art historical context?
I'd like to say that I'm attempting to be, you know, I'm attempting to, get there. And I think that there's what's really exciting is painting so broad at the moment, and there's so many brilliant painters at the moment working, and it's I almost feel like Instagram's made it more accessible. You know, you don't have to be in London, you can be anywhere in the world. I mean, for ages I was just working in my garden, and Instagram made it look like I could be elsewhere, you know, could be in London. So I think that's a really exciting momentum going on with painting right now, and it's great to be a part of that.
I feel like especially with like this momentum feels like it's very British based. I feel like the USA has had the Ninth Street Women, and they've had this abstract expressionist movement, but now it feels like in Britain we have a really female-led or non-binary-led movement with ABX. You know, we're looking at Jade Fadjatimi and Rachel Jones. I feel like you're part of it, Francesca Mollett. And I feel like there's older artists like Varda Kavino, Victoria Morton, Hayley Tompkins, who have been doing this. But now it's all really starting to come together. And I'm feeling the instinct that it's a movement that can come to Britain. This ABX moment. Brilliant. But like female-led or non-binary female-led, you know? Do you feel part of a kind of contemporary moment with that then?
Definitely. I mean, I think even some of the painters you've mentioned I haven't met, some I have, but we're aware of each other. And I think that there's a real moment for us to just take painting to the next level, however that may manifest, however that may look. But I think people are so committed, you know, and liberated and empowered, and it's brilliant. And I think there's an unstoppable charge going on.
Yeah, and so, and actually there were two moments I had in Art Basel in June 2022, earlier this summer, and it was seeing Rachel Jones's painting they had on the gallery booth, and then seeing your painting at the Approaches booth, and they both kind of stopped me in their tracks for similarish reasons, not because I mean visually I actually think your works are quite different, but and also the thinking behind it is very different too, but I felt like there's this real like holding of the past, like holding the hand of the past. Yes. So it's almost familiar when you first see it, but then when you actually look, you're like, this is like nothing I've ever seen before, and it's really pushing, creating something new. And I was really baffled, particularly by your one as well, because I knew Rachel's language quite strongly, but I wasn't as sort of familiar in real life with yours. Like I hadn't, you know, stood in front of a giant painting, and really that was a giant painting. And it had so many things going on, like it was such a complicated work, and it made me feel all these different things. But I like the future, you know, the future looking element of it.
Oh, that's really, honestly, that's so nice to be told. You can't really fully understand what people actually think when you go to your exhibition. And I'd go in there undercover just to kind of maybe for my own, you know, to look at the work and take it all in again. But also, you know, you'd hear comments or you'd have conversations, and they didn't actually know that you're the one that made
what have
work.
You heard what have you heard good have you heard good and bad?
This is good.
I'm trying to think now. I say that, but I can't even remember. Well, I remember, do you know what? It was my last day, and there was a sausage dog that was my last ever guest, and that was the best one by far.
And what was the review? What did the sausage dog think?
He wagged his tail a lot, let me tell you.
Dogs love art. They live
dogs,
for it.
Dogs love abstract expressionism above everything else. It's a fact.
You know, this idea of like having to paint, having to create, having to make art. Yeah. I've heard that you definitely have that. Like you wake up in the morning and you feel like I have to paint today. And if you don't, you go crazy. Can we go back like 2 years to the lockdown, to what I referenced in the introduction, and this makeshift kind of garden studio in the south coast of England, which I don't know where on the south coast it was, which I'm quite fascinated by. But can you talk about that and painting outdoors, like plein air painting almost?
Yes, so I was doing my MA when lockdown happened. I was in my first year. And
this is the Royal College of Art you were doing your MA.
Yeah, exactly. And I was struggling to stay in London anyway. I was already kind of thinking, was this the right decision to make doing an MA? So I was kind of on the cusp of thinking, do I leave? And then lockdown happened. So I was basically made to leave anyways. sort of decision made for me.
What, can we just, why did you feel like it wasn't, why did you want to leave the course? What was the feeling there then?
I just felt like it was a lot of money for really what you get. And I guess I had a lot of expectations. And I think a lot of students get let down by some courses in art school. And just unfortunately, it just didn't feel like it met the financial
commitment.
Requirements. Mm. Commitment. So that was where I was. And I just thought, right, let's, you know, and then COVID happened. So I took a year out. And I thought, right, let's just go home and see what I can do there. So I went home. I live in West Sussex. Do you know West Sussex?
Is that near sort Brighton? No.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, sort of near Brighton. I'm like an hour away. I'm in this small place called Bracklesham, West Wittering.
Oh, right.
sort of. It's very quiet. It's very quiet there. And, you know, there's not a lot going on, but there's sort of a beach and you can walk and do that sort of thing. But, you know, I was stuck there. I was waitressing and I was thinking, oh, how do I keep on painting? And so I thought, well, I'll build myself a self-standing wall outside and I'll just paint outside. And I did this through winter, you know, gloves, layers, for no other reason really than to just realize, why do I actually paint? You know, what's the reason for me painting? If I can't get up every day and I don't want to paint, then maybe it's not the right thing for me. But I actually found that in this kind of place of isolation, being alone, seeing very few people, I found out that actually it's the only thing I wanted to do. And it was, it kept me entertained. And as you say, with the boredom thing, I think when you're really bored, you can actually be surprised at what things you make creatively. And yeah, just day in, day out, I worked out there and it was very much exposed to the elements. I had this sort of makeshift roof that kind of protected the work from the rain and things. But it almost became sort of challenge that I was willing to accept. And I'd just go out there every day and see what would happen. And it was very raw and unedited. And it was just this moment in my life, which I can always look back on and say, I really learned something from that.
Were you able then to quit the waitressing job at some point? You haven't kept this going.
Yeah. Oh, I know that story.
No, not.
But that's because of our support pledge, isn't it?
Yes, so I was selling works on Artist Support Pledge to just get materials and, you know.
Can you explain what that is for people? That this was a thing that was devised, that came up during COVID, which was incredibly inspiring. But what was the process of the Artist Support Pledge?
So basically you would put up five artworks, small artworks for I think £200, I think it was. And if you've sold up to five, you'd then buy someone else's work and then you'd sort of do the whole thing again. So that's what I did. I got a nice Phil Allen etching.
Cool.
Yeah. I can't remember who else's work I bought. I got quite a couple of works because I did it so much. And it really just helped me earn money and it meant I could stop waitressing. And then eventually I got enough money to get a studio in London. And really that artist support pledge helped me get the rent to stay there. Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea is you make small works, don't you? That are within that price bracket, depending on where you're at in your career, I guess.
Is it still going? Or did it stop?
It's definitely not what it was. I mean, everyone was doing it.
Yeah.
And you'd do the hashtag. And I mean, there was literally everyone I know was sort of doing this.
And the guy who founded it, Matthew Burrows, he got an MBE, didn't he?
It's well deserved because, I mean, you know, I think it really it rescued me from relying on a sort of everyday job and being able to just fully commit to painting. It was my route into being self-sufficient on my painting.
So cool. And giving you that budget meant that you were able to get more materials and get these bigger canvases. So what is the drive for you with the bigger canvases? And you were talking about, you know, right at the beginning about using your shoulder and your arm. There's this big expression that you are really committed to. And it feels like these canvases are so much bigger than you that, you know, again, this self-sabotage, it feels like you're testing yourself. Can I achieve even bigger? And do you have ambitions to go beyond?
Yeah, it's funny because the size thing, I think I'm a big person. I'm quite big in general. And I think like my height and my arms can really stretch out. So for me, there is a level of comfort now to the scale. But really the vast amount of space and the fact that I could put these canvases on the floor and all of a sudden the gravity is shifted in the painting. So instead of there being the physics of ground, sky, horizon, it's on the floor where my feet are. And it's almost like you're writing in sand or something. The whole kind of physiology and physics of this painting shifts completely, and then you can spin it on its head, and again you're in a whole other perspective. And it's just that physicality that really ends up asking a lot from the painter, and you're almost reacting to it. And I think the scale just helps put you out of your comfort zone, but in a really comfortable way. Maybe I've just got used to it, I think.
I heard that you like to extend the paintbrush as well, and that you use things like brooms and mops, and then you've got loads of shovels and all kinds of stuff. But you also have lots of hidden secrets, which is a good thing, I think, because you don't want everyone else to just start making, you know, copies of your work somehow. You know what I mean? Copying your techniques. I mean. But how did that first happen? Like, was that a really exciting thing to discover when you can sort of extend the brush?
Yeah, so that was just about distancing my control. So again, it's putting something between my brain and my hand and elbow, you know, and there's an extension, and then there's the tool. Instead of it being sort of close to the wrist, it's beyond you. And that distance really, it affects the signature of the hand enormously. There's that lack of control, and that just helps loosen up. It helps the painting kind of go into a direction where things are just opened up, and forms, you can surprise yourself, forms can come out of this, and you familiarize yourself with it, but just from a distance. It's hard to describe actually, but it's just about, it's about having lots of different ways of broadening a language and different methods to achieve a similar thing, which is a painting at the end.
Will all these methods go into an individual painting, or can you find yourself working like with a sponge in one work and then you go to the next work and you work with, is it quite a binary process, or do all these energies come into one work?
I think it all comes into one work. Yeah, so normally I start a painting with a stick of charcoal, and normally I put it on a long extension so I can reach to the top, reach low, and have that fluidity to make the footprint of the painting. And then
so it always starts in drawing then.
Drawing's really important, but it's something that just takes time. Like it's almost ahead of you, it's almost ahead of painting, because it's sort of so direct, but it just takes me a long time to come around and accept the fact that that's where I'm going.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
So it's like way ahead.
I love that. Can we also talk about your palette as well? You described at some point that you like to introduce meaty tones, which really appealed to me for some reason, even though I'm a vegetarian. I really liked the idea of that. But there feels this kind of cartoony element. And these do feel art historical, but yet they're contemporary, but yet they're also timeless. But I think what brings them for me to date is that there's these neon flashes going through them, which feels like a very modern palette. Do you look to cartoons and kind of the color palette of animation in some ways in your work?
Do you know, I've never thought of that. That's a first. I don't. But I could start.
You've got to. No, yeah, I'm not telling you to do that. But I'm just that's what I see, because I mean I love pop art. That's how I got into loving art, is through cartoons, things like Tintin, the palette of comic books.
Yes.
And I'm really responding to a lot of artists like yourself, like Rachel Jones, we're talking about, who, and Jade, who have these fluoro flashes that kind of go through the work, which differentiates it from art historical Abex painting that I've seen before. And I'm really responding to that.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's an incredible observation. I think it's something that I've not made that link myself. I can definitely see why you've read it. For me, it was sort of this idea of the saturated, the oversaturated, and then the more kind of masked, or something's being pushed back and pushed forward, and there's that vibration of colours. And you can sort of feel it in the air, like between you and the painting, with what's going on with the palette. But maybe that's also just a comment on our generation and what's feeding us visually, because on Instagram, there's like that constant stream of information. Yeah. And similarly to a cartoon, it's sort of this repetition of boxes and colour and flashing, and maybe that does feed into the work. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it had an effect.
Like a comic strip,
Yeah, definitely.
So Instagram is a tool that you are referencing a lot, and you're on Instagram and you're... But no, but that is the thing, you know, that's how a lot of people are seeing art, discovering art.
Yeah, definitely. I'm on it to see kind of what people are doing at my age, people are doing at the moment. Right now it's great because I can sort of see what's happening in London, see what shows are on, but you know, I can't go to them. So it's just nice to be able to have that. I think it's great. I think it connects people. I know there's negatives as well, but for me, I think it's really a brilliant platform for artists to link up. I've met amazing people on there.
I know there's this metaphor that keeps reappearing with your work, which I guess you must have started, I think, to do with excavating and archaeology, which Russ talked about earlier. But are you interested in like the pigments themselves? You know, we were talking about the colour a second ago. Like, do you ever have like raw pigment, or have you ever used that within the work?
I have a deep respect for it, but I've never dabbled with the raw pigments and making paint myself. Yeah. I would love to. I just think that for now it was the immediacy that a paint tube gives is perfect for what I need. Sometimes I will like put things in the paint or mix up a bit with the mediums I use, but other than that, no, I don't. I keep to the tubes.
And you predominantly use oil paint though, don't you?
Yeah.
And why is oil paint so sort of, what does it deliver for you personally?
I think with oil paint, there's this real depth to colour, and also it's a slow dryer. So you need this patience that I think acrylic kind of eliminates waiting time, which for some people it really works. But for me, I almost like to have to wait or scrape back, and it just keeps the malleable pace of the painting going. It's like almost with sculpture, you know how sculpture artists sort of put wet damp cloths on their sculpture and then they revisit it and it's still wet and malleable. I think that's a really important quality to my gestures. You know, I can sort of shift them and change them and mold them, and it being wet is a very important aspect to that.
I guess the slow process also allows a history to develop within the painting, the layering.
Yes.
But that process, it's not immediate. You do have to wait. And it feels like you really celebrate the slowing down and the quiet and having to wait and embracing the boredom.
Yeah, totally. This is a brilliant thing that Philip Guston says, where he realizes a painting quite early on and he just goes, I haven't lived in it long enough, and he just scrapes the whole thing off and starts again, or you know, gets back into it. And there's something to be said about that that comment has really resonated with me ever since.
That I love that. Is that hard to give the paintings out into the world. If you are living with them and they do feed into the process, what's it like having to then consign them to a gallery and they're off?
I get really sick of my own work as well, so it's fine.
Right.
You know, you live with, the thing is you're so sort of invested in a painting, you see it every day, and you're sort of committed to it. As soon as it's finished, it's almost as if, you know, you're done with it. It's not yours anymore. And I'm just really comfortable with then letting it go off and be seen. I mean, that's the greatest privilege, is the fact that, you know, a painting gets seen by the public. I really love that.
Is language really important to you, as in like the written word, like poetry or literature? Because everything I've read around the way that you describe art is really poetic. Like Russ and I were talking about it earlier. You've got a really wonderful use of language and like just the way that you describe things. Do you read loads, or like maybe you don't? I don't know. It's just,
we had a conversation the other day, me and Pam online, and I was talking to you about this language, and I said to you, do you keep a diary? Like a daily diary where you jot down ideas, because I've just been watching the Andy Warhol Diaries on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
It was like crack cocaine, like literally every night. I was like, oh my God, I get to watch another one. It was amazing.
So this brilliant diary.
And I said this to you, and then you came out with something incredibly profound. Like you said earlier on about the reflection in the dark sea and everybody's skin and how it stayed with you. And you come up with this thing about Munch. And then I was like, right, write it down. And have you been writing?
I actually have. So I have been. Hang on, I've got proof. Although it's a bit. So here we go.
There we go. Okay. So okay. Check. I've considered proof. Yes. All right. You've been working.
But yeah, no. I mean, I think so. I then realised that after our conversation, I don't think it counts for writing, but I have this sort of stream of consciousness list where I just. Every day I'll put a few words in. So it's funny, I forgot I did that, but I'm so used to doing it that I'm almost unconscious of doing it now. But that's where like my titles will come from. It's sort of this sort of everyday list that just keeps going on. But since you said writing things down, I have been trying to do it. And I was talking to Mike Silver, an amazing painter who recently had the solo in Anton Kern. So when I was in the Independent, he had his solo show. It was absolutely incredible. But we were talking and he was, I've got it written down. So he basically paints people, and we were talking about being sophisticated with paint. So I was saying, oh, if you try too hard with painting and you try and be too fussy or too clever, do you lose something? You know, I was looking at, Alfred Wallace, and the naivety of his touch. He's not trying to be too clever. He's not trying to show off too much. It exposes something raw and more felt. Mm. And we were sort of discussing sort of empathy in paint. And he paints people he lives with and has a real connection with. And the way he paints them is very intimate. And you can almost feel that he has that level of empathy with the way he paints. Anyway, we were talking about that and how sometimes being too clever with paint can disguise something a bit more meaningful. And perhaps sometimes you've got to sit with yourself and allow the ugly bits to come out because they'll actually say a lot more.
Mm.
So that was, I wrote that down.
Love
what
that.
What was the thing? Have you got it written down, what you said the other night about, you know, swimming at?
Oh, yeah. Well,
did you write that down, or was that just to me on Instagram?
It's not with me.
Oh, okay, right.
What did I say?
I can't remember.
What was it about Edvard Munch?
I think it was about the sea moment. Let me find it now. It was really profound and articulate and brilliant. But yeah, and you were saying about the Independent, that's an art fair that happens in New York, and you had a solo booth there with your gallery, the Approach Gallery, which would be great to talk about, because Jake Miller, who's director of the Approach, this is a gallery above a pub, the Approach Pub in East London, which is part of art history from the London art movement.
And
he is
Emma, yeah. of course.
And Emma, and yes. Emma, yes.
Emma's also the director, isn't she?
Yes, yeah, yes, yes. yes. And it's
yeah.
it's
he, yeah, both of them. Yeah,
I found them incredibly generous over the years. Me and Rob both have, and the approach has been a really important gallery. And what has that been like? While I'm trying to find your piece here, what is it? What was that like? How did you meet Jake and Emma? And what has it been like working with the Approach Gallery, who are kind of part of the establishment?
I love the fact that you've said all that, because both Emma and Jake have been incredible to work with, and they just really understand how to allow a painter to have those moments of solitude, and like what I'm doing now, and be just totally cool with it. But they're fascinating. And so the Approach Gallery is the gallery I used to go to all the time as a student. I'd go to all the openings. I'd really make an effort to see those exhibitions. Mm-hmm. So I've valued it for a long time. And I'm sort of aware also of its presence, because a lot of older painters talk about the Approach often.
Yeah.
So it's got this sort of legacy. I met Jake first. He came to my Slade degree show, and we just briefly met then. I met Emma in passing, just by visiting the Approach, and I realized who Emma was, and we talked. And then I guess there was just meeting them occasionally at the Approach often, and then they sort of bridged the conversation by actually showing interest in the work. And then it went from there, and it's a beautiful relationship that's kind of come out of it.
I love that happened for you, because I always tell students, like I'd sometimes teach at RCA, you know, as a visiting lecturer or whatever, even over Zoom and stuff, or Goldsmiths or in different art schools across the UK. But I always tell people, like, if you have a program that you love, go to their openings, get to know the people who work there, because often those people Definitely. Go and set their own galleries up as well, and maybe that'll be your new home. Do you know what I mean? And I think passion, and real passion though, like a genuine thing, like find what you love, and then you'll find the like-minded people. And it's really that, it's actually not that complicated in a way. Like, I think if it's genuine and it's like a truthful thing, like you were really connected to their program. I mean, I think the Approach showed people like Michael Radecker, like way, way before,
yeah.
you know, like they did really interesting shows. And then sometimes the artists went on to other galleries and stuff. But like, I think it was, yeah, they've been incredible, incredible. Like they have a really good legacy, I think, within that
yeah,
East totally. London,
yeah,
along with like Maureen and different galleries there.
Maureen Paley, yeah.
Yeah, I love the East London. I just love East London, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a big fan of East London. But yeah, I think they've always managed to kind of refresh their gallery as well. And I think it's just a really exciting time again for them. And it's just great to be on their programme and be a part of that.
Yeah, I loved their Jack Lavender show. I thought that was extraordinary. Like that installation,
yeah.
like something out of another planet. It was just amazing. You know, you think Mike Silver and the empathy in his figurative paintings of people. That's what I wanted to talk to you about as well, because your paintings, if you look at them, people describe them as abstract. And I know that you see it like that too, because you're referencing landscape and whatever. But also the thing that I've heard you talk about is like in non-representational work, it's more the idea of the line, the form of the visual art, like the actual art form itself, and then linking to emotion and feeling, and that you want to like, you know, put the feeling in, but in a very different way to Mike Silver, like the empathy you're talking about. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's funny because me and Mike, I mean, we've been having this sort of constant voice message exchange the whole time I've been here. It's literally nonstop. But oddly, we have so many similarities, even though our work is so different. And I feel like portraiture or self-portraiture resigns itself in like the handwriting more in my work, but there's definitely a presence. So like even how Hodgkin talks about it, because he kind of was determined to stick to the fact that his paintings were actually comments on the everyday, and in his titles you see the references to exteriors or landscapes. And I just think that life is just so kind of bizarre and surprising anyway, and actually quite abstract when you really think about it, that in a way that language touches on it in a very kind of cutting way, even more so than just describing what visually something looks like. It's like looking in and seeing beyond what actually visually the aesthetics are. So that's kind of how I see it.
When it comes to your language, do you witness recurring motifs that you either kind of fight against or invite in?
Probably. I feel like maybe I haven't been painting long enough. I think with me, there's sort of muscle memory. I don't know if I've said that earlier, but I think that I witness a pattern and also habits. So habits is a big thing with me, because I kind of approach a painting when I realize I'm doing the same thing I did maybe with the last two. And I guess familiarizing myself with habits and deciding which ones I want to keep and which ones I want to abolish,
yes,
is the way I go about it.
I can relate that to being an actor in the fact that it's tricks that you have, things you rely on. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I need that now because I'm unsure of what I'm doing. And other times I'm like, I'm doing that thing that I rely on when I'm unsure of something. So it's a constant battle of letting things come in that you go, okay, that's a default, but that works for this moment. And other times like, fuck off default. I want to find something fresher here. And it's a really interesting thing within creativity.
That's really similar. That's really revealing actually about acting, because I don't know many actors, but I can definitely see it. And it's almost similar to painting in so far as you've got to be so self-aware, but then also abandon yourself in moments
and try and discover something as that character that's new and fresh and different in storytelling.
I actually heard you describe, Pam, that you were kind of like, it's almost like better to be anti-style, like someone asked you a question about like style and you were like, well, actually you almost don't want to have a style as such because that's limiting.
Yeah,
just to have like one thing that you do or something.
Yeah, it's tricky because I think that every painter, once they've made a large amount of work, they put themselves in a corner, and to get out of that corner you have to do things which you're not very comfortable with, or just change the angle, or just try and expose yourself to another method of making. And I mean, recently I've been using drawing as that. That's why I value drawing so much, because I do think it just broadens the scope of what's possible. Yeah, I think style is problematic, and I think that there's a phony element to style.
Yeah.
And I do think it's a trap, and I just think there's so much more to painting than finding this one way and sticking to it.
Yeah, we've actually been, Russ and I are both obsessed with Cassie Nomoda's work. I don't know if you know her work. She's a painter. She's now showing at Xavier Hufkins, actually. She's amazing. And she's really good at like, you always know it's her, but she sort of, everything she does is a completely new shift. And it's like, she's recently been painting on ceramic tiles, and like, I don't know, like her vocabulary.
It's kind of like Toyin as well. Toyin Giotolo recreates a body of work, and it's in a whole different medium, and it's a different, and it's still her,
them, but it's like something so different. And I respect that so much. And I don't even think it's conscious, though. I think it's just something they obviously do. But, you know, the studio life, like we're looking at you right now in the studio. I've heard you describe many times that it's chaotic and that you have to, like, fight the chaos. What is it like a day in the studio for you? Do you listen to music? Do you eat food? Like, how do you survive and sustain yourself?
I feel like there's definitely a level of, I've become so sort of used to being in the white walls of a studio space, and this is nice because it kind of abolishes that white wall box that I'm really used to. But usually in that sort of studio environment, there's no distractions coming from the white walls, so you become very inward in thinking, and the painting then becomes sort of manifestation of a very inward psychological approach. And I'm just sort of very aware of how like different environments affect me in my mind and in my body, and even the food I eat, how that may affect the way I paint, or the sort of day I'm having. But yeah, chaotic, I suppose I said that about when I have a lot of work going on, it starts to become this very overwhelming space. And the only way I can keep going in that sort of environment is just being more selective and with what works I work on, and try and keep things moderately in control, and then now and again allowing the chaos to kind of resurface and then settle it all down again, clear things up, and then let things go wild. And it's that sort of, you need to, it took me a while to understand how to properly manage a studio and how I best work. And for me, it's sort of, I treat it almost like it's just life, and you go there, you live it every day. And sometimes things will go really smoothly, and other times it's a complete car crash and you're just sort of picking up the pieces and just thinking, oh, what day.
So you paint every day?
Almost.
Do you like having the studio to go to, or does it bleed back into your home life as well?
Well, for a long time, I actually lived directly in my studio. So I had no kind of distinction between my private sort of life and the studio. It all kind of got merged. And that became incredibly intense. At the moment, I actually live below. So I can go down, have a shower and come back up, you know, whatever it is. So, yeah, I think it's nice to have a distance. I think it's important. I remember, you know, at one point I was commuting from down south to London. It took me 4 hours to get to my studio.
Yeah. Daily?
And I would just, well, so I would go up and then I'd stay a couple of nights and go back.
Oh.
Yeah, but like that journey, I thought it was going to get to me. I did it for about, that sort of commuting I did for about a year.
Wow.
And actually it was the best thing, because my journey would really inform what I would then do in the studio. And actually it made me really make the most of being in that space, because
slowing
it took
down. Me so long. You've been forced, forced to slow down.
But also having the focused days there. Because you knew you were going to, yeah, that's interesting. Because it's not so close.
They're so valuable.
Yeah, so you have to really focus when you're in the studio.
Yeah, and just make the most of it, because you made all the effort to get there. So you can't just put your legs up and, you know, think, oh, you know, I've got all this open time. It was actually, I've got this few days, I've got to make the most of it before I have to head back.
Do you listen to music in the studio?
Yes, I do. I'm listening to, at the moment, I've been listening to Iggy Pop.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Do you think the music plays a role in the work? Like,
Definitely. I think it affects your attitude. So, you know, if you really want something to get you in the mood of and a pace that's really energetic, you choose sort of something that's wild or unhinged, or you can choose something like jazz or something that slows you down a bit more. It's so important actually what you have on, really. I mean, if I have the news, and it's, you know, the news can be such a distraction, because most of the time it's so blooming depressing.
Yeah, and it's also fear-based, isn't it? It's becoming increasingly fear-based over the last few decades. But yeah, and then that just probably destroys anything for you, like creatively. Horrible.
It definitely, I now only listen to the news sort of either the 11, the night news, you know, when it's on later, or I have it on in the morning and then recover during the day after what I've just listened to, you know. Mm-hmm. So I can't have that on all the time. But music's really, really the one thing I really love having on in the background. Or just white sort of music that's almost like white noise, not too many words. And then you can really kind of enter your own sort of focus. But it changes depending on what I need.
Ross, you love a bit of white noise, don't you?
I love white noise.
I love there's brown numerous, noise. There's new brown noise.
Brown noise? What is brown noise?
I'm into brown noise.
Never heard of that.
Brown noise is a new thing and it really calms you, and people are listening to brown noise to go to sleep. Wow. It's a real focus thing. People who have ADHD are really responding to brown noise.
Really?
It's a whole science. Yeah, you need to get into brown noise, guys.
The amount of times I've been in hotel rooms with Russ where we're like on a trip somewhere and then he's like playing white noise and then I have to sit in the same room and I'm like, why am I doing this?
Not anymore.
Never again.
I don't do that anymore, but I did. But it did help me for a while. A few quick fire questions. What is your top studio snack?
Yeah, you're not getting out of that one.
No, you're covering your mouth. You're gonna say what?
I've just looked over and there's a box of Maltesers. So there's your answer.
I love Maltesers. We're like kindred spirits.
Gone bright red.
Are you a tea or coffee drinker?
Tea. I drink way too much tea. In just cups of tea, endless cups of tea. Yeah.
Very good.
With milk.
With milk. With
no
with,
sugar.
With whole milk, or are you a plant-based milk?
Whole milk.
Good. And what is the brand of the paint you use?
Oh, at the moment, so I do use a bit of a mix, but at the moment I've really splurged out on Old Holland. It's amazing. It's the pigments, the range, I mean, it's really something, that paint. And it's a pure luxury to paint with. Yeah.
What is your studio fashion? What is your go-to outfit if you're working?
It's not really, I don't think I'd call it fashion. It's sort of some grubby old shorts and a grubby old top covered in paint.
Love.
not a look.
I think it's a look. I think it is. People have been writing about that for centuries. Do you consider future generations looking at your artwork?
I would love that to be the case. I'm definitely ambitious with painting, but I don't sort of think about it actively, but I think if that was to ever be the case, that would be pretty cool. But it's just, I think at the moment, I'm just trying to discover. And, you know, if I achieve anything, then that would be really exciting.
Well, I mean, you said earlier on in your moments of loneliness, you think about what you have achieved so far, and you have achieved an incredible amount. And then you've just mentioned you're ambitious with painting. What are your ambitions when it comes to career and when it comes to your personal practice?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question because career comes up a lot, and career sort of is driving a lot of art education at the moment. It's very career based. For me, it's a bit of a dangerous term because I think that if you paint towards a career, it's a bit dangerous. I think my ambitions reside themselves in really trying to understand paint and find out how far I can take painting. That is my key drive, and really having exhibitions enable that because you have a deadline and that really pushes yourself to come up with solutions and put on a show, and it's really benefits the work. But I think, I don't know, that I just have a problem with sometimes how thinking about career can really kind of put you a few steps back in the studio. And I think that that's something I'm mindful of, but if I think about it too much, it will actually significantly stall me in the work.
It will slow you down, but not in a good way, not in the way you want.
I think it's really interesting, the idea of professionalizing creativity, and that you're right, it's such a thing within education now because they love to like tick boxes and do things in a very ordered way, which is fine if you're studying finance or if you're doing business or you're doing all these different things. But when it comes to creativity, it's the same in music or even graphic design and things like that. I know even in that world they do adverts and stuff, but it's like, I agree with you. I think it's incredibly problematic, and I actually think arts education is just like in a, you know, there's an amazing range of teachers though, still. I mean, there's some incredible teachers at the RCA, all the teachers I meet are incredible, but even they are being restricted and, you know, at the end of their tether when they're stressed out because of the way they're being treated by the organizations. It's appalling.
Yeah. The Slade is an amazing. I did my BA there, and that still manages to keep this core focus on painting or making, and the conversations, the crits there are just phenomenal. So I would push anyone, if they're looking at art schools in London, look at the Slade, because the teachers there are phenomenal. And I think it's the best art school in London, yeah, to be honest.
And also,
and it's a beautiful building.
Yeah,
that's true. But also, they're still running proper courses where, yeah, it's like, you know, 2-3 years, whatever. Whereas other plate institutions seem to be turning into 1-year master programs and stuff, which is ludicrous in a subject like painting. It's like 1 year is not long enough, I'm afraid. Well, we ask every guest 2 questions, as you may well know. The first question is, if you could do an imaginary art heist anywhere around the world, we can help you. It can be giant, it can be tiny. Which artwork would you take home?
Okay, I've definitely got my answer ready. So I went to New York for the first time, which is where you are, isn't it? You're in New
York. I'm in New York now, right now, yeah.
Yeah. So I went to the MoMA, mm-hmm, and it was the most incredible. I think I went 3 times. I was only there for 4 days, and I kept on having to go back because it was just the most life-changing experience going there. And Matisse's painting, The Piano Lesson, it just, it moved me. I've never been moved quite like that. I mean, actually, all of Matisse's painting in that room, I stood there and I just shrunk. I got consumed by it. And I would just, I think that painting is just a masterpiece.
There's an incredible curation that's up there at the minute, which is a Matisse. Was that on when you were there?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, it was. Oh my gosh. Also Susan Rothenberg.
Oh, I love Susan Rothenberg.
She had loads of her work all out.
Okay, I need to go.
Well, she passed away, didn't she?
It was really good.
I think she passed away, and they must have done an exhibition after that, I think. Her work was so, in a way, I mean, she did get, I guess in the art world, she did exhibit, but I feel like she was always
slightly overlooked.
Yeah, totally overlooked.
Her work's amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
I think a Susan Rothenberg horse painting is kind of slowly inching up on my personal art heist. I think that works amazing. No, but anybody listening for the Matisse, if the Red Studio show is still on, the curation there, I remember I walked in and I was like, this is kind of confusing. I don't know what's going on. It's quite a small curation. And then suddenly the penny dropped and I was like, ah, this is genius. And you're kind of seeing everything in the Red Studio is actually surrounding you in the exhibition space suddenly. And it's like, oh my God, all the ephemera. There's like a plate and a small kind of wooden, it's amazing. Thank you for that one. The other question is, what is your favorite color?
I've got it all sorted in my head, what I'm going to say. So basically I was thinking of paint again, pigments. And there's just, I mean, it's called raw umber. It's this sort of rusty brown. And it's a very sort of cheap paint and a very sort of easy paint to get hold of. And it's kind of made of like earth pigments. I just think it's a fascinatingly resilient and broad pigment to use. And Vermeer used this as normally an underpainting, Rembrandt as well. And it sort of can be illuminated from behind, and it's just very versatile. It's got something about it. So that's my favorite color as a painter answer.
Do you find yourself battling to reduce how much you introduce it into your work, or is it something you're always going towards and enjoying having that around you?
Well, the thing is I actually cut it out years ago because I was using it too much. Right. So I sort of, you know, thought, right, I'm going to drop that for a while. And only recently have I brought it back. So we'll see how I have changed my way of using it. It's sort of this brown that is very, very specific brown, but it's got this beautiful expanse to it. And I'm thinking of using it for when I'm painting about the nightlight, and hopefully that will help me sort of grasp the kind of weight and mood of nighttime. But I haven't yet attempted it, so we'll see.
What is the best advice you've received
ever when it comes to your art?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually. I've been given so much good advice over the time. Probably don't be too precious. That was an early on advice I got. And I think it really kind of has made me the sort of painter I am, not being too precious about what I'm making.
Very good. I found your message to me. I went swimming at 1 a.m., pitch black. And what was amazing was our bodies were all illuminated like a real life Munch painting. And I said to you, start writing these things down because I think it will make a great diary, a great Andy Warr, Pan Evelyn diary, Netflix special coming up. What's coming up for you then next? Where are these paintings going? Do you know?
I'm keeping things pretty cool at the moment. So there's definitely discussions happening. But at the moment, I'm just taking the pace down a bit, focusing back on painting and just having these conversations, but they're very much in the mindset of let's make the work now and enable those opportunities when the time's right. So that's kind of my position at the moment.
Yeah, I saw Tracy last night, Lindsay Mendick's performance, and they were talking about this advice that Tracy had been given from somebody where they said you've got to always make sure you protect and prioritize the studio rather than the show. And often people try and prioritize the show and then they fit around their work to a show. And Tracy said that she's never done that because she was given that advice of like, you know, really prioritize the work, the studio, because out of that, you'll find even the tiniest, you know, scrap of paper with a drawing on, or well, different things can become the show later. And the opportunities will come if your studio life is vibrant and, you know, flowing well. So in a way, that's the priority. And I think for an artist at your, you know, stage, in a sense, you're just beginning your career, you know, you've just graduated, you're just kind of on your journey in life. It's like, it's really important to remember that everything comes from the work. It's like, it's just
absolutely.
And it's also the simplest thing. That's what I find sometimes the best advice is like simple, isn't it? It's like the most obvious, but it's the thing that none of us remember because we all get caught up in. And that's also why I think professionalizing art too much is just a negative thing, because it makes people worry about the wrong motivations or end goals. Oh my God, it's been such a joy to meet you. Thank you.
I've loved it.
So much to Jake Miller and to Emma Robertson at The Approach as well. For showing your work in the UK, and you're also in a group show at Massimo Di Carlo. I think that's still on.
Yes, that's right.
That's in Milan.
What you see is what you get. It's just finished, actually.
Oh, it's just finished.
But it's been a great show. Betty Parsons was in it.
God, I loved it. That work, that was my, I can't believe you highlighted that. That was the work for me in the show alongside yours.
Oh, amazing.
I think her work's just major, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And I think she was like a gallerist.
Yeah, she was,
painted something like that.
Yeah, and she really fought for the Abex really early on. She was one of the first people, I think. Yeah, I read all about her, actually. I love her paintings.
It was brilliant. It was a brilliant show to be a part of. And they've been really fun to work with as well.
Brilliant.
Very cool gallery.
Where can people find you on? Are you on Instagram? You are, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yep, Pam Evelyn on Instagram.
Okay, and we'll link to you there. And you can go to At The Approach Gallery and Perez Projects, and you'll find it all at Pam's page. So we'll be back very soon. Season 14 has started.
It has. I'm
already remembering why we do this.
Yes, invigorated by art and by conversations. And for everybody listening, go to our talk art, and you can go to Pam's talk art and our talk art. I know there'll be images on there from when this episode goes out. Thank you, Pam.
Oh, thank you so much. I've really loved it.
See you all soon.
Okay. We'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.